You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. The name of this program is The Great Leap Forward. My name is John Malkin, and this program airs every Wednesday night from 7 to 9 p.m. and is devoted to exploring social change and spiritual growth. Free Radio Santa Cruz is now in its 8th year of commercial-free, community-based broadcasting without a license from the FCC. You can listen to Free Radio Santa Cruz on the internet at www.freakradio.org. Tonight I have a very special guest on the telephone, Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq. Scott Ritter was also a Marine intelligence officer who served in the Gulf War, and he led UN weapons inspections teams in Iraq until 1998. He is also the author of the recently released book, Frontier Justice, Weapons of Mass Destruction and the Bushwhacking of America. Scott Ritter, I want to welcome you to the program.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like you to begin by briefly describing for all of us your background as a Marine intelligence officer and then as a leader of one of the UN weapons inspection teams in Iraq for 7 years. I wonder if you could tell me about your activities in those capacities and why you eventually resigned as a UN weapons inspector.
Well, I think my involvement in the United Nations program was pure serendipity. It was being at the right place at the right time. I was commissioned as an officer in the Marine Corps in 1984 after graduating college. I had a major in Russian history, which showed up on my records as a Marine intelligence officer. And in 1987, when Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev signed the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the Department of Defense was tasked with putting together a team of weapons inspectors to go to Russia and or the Soviet Union and implement this treaty. And the Marine Corps was required to, you know, turn over a certain number of officers. The Marine Corps scoured their databases, found I spoke Russian, and suddenly I found myself transferred from a combat arms unit in 29 Palms, California, to a weapons inspection assignment in Washington, D.C., in the heartland of the Soviet Union, and I spent 2 years as a weapons inspector. I left that job in July of 1990. In August of 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and the United States found itself gearing up for war, and I was assigned to the intelligence staff on General Schwarzkopf's headquarters unit in Saudi Arabia, and because of my experience as a missile inspector in the former Soviet Union, I became heavily involved in the counter-Scud effort, trying to track down Iraqi Scud missiles before they were fired against Israel or targets in the Gulf Arab countries. The war ended, and the United Nations suddenly found itself required by the Security Council to put together a team of weapons inspectors to go in and disarm Iraq of their weapons of mass destruction. Iraq lied, they cheated, they hid, they obfuscated, they concealed, and the UN weapons inspectors needed to put together an intelligence unit that would assist in trying to break through this wall of deception that the Iraqis had built. And they needed somebody who was an intelligence officer, understood the trade of intelligence, somebody who had experience in arms control, weapons inspections, and somebody who knew something about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. And my name popped up, and I was asked to create this intelligence unit. And I did. I started in 1991. It was supposed to be a two-month job. It was extended to a six-month job, and it became a seven-year experience. And it was a good experience, very important job to get rid of weapons of mass destruction, to establish a precedent of multilateral disarmament run by the United Nations. Unfortunately, in addition to combating Iraqi concealment efforts and Iraqi efforts to retain capabilities they weren't allowed to. I also had to battle, I and other inspectors had to battle American unilateral policies of regime removal, getting rid of Saddam Hussein, which, it's a policy that wasn't sanctioned by international law, wasn't sanctioned by a Security Council resolution. It was purely the unilateral policy objectives of the United States government. And they were policy objectives which the United States chose to implement by corrupting the integrity of the inspection process, by using the unique access afforded to the United Nations in regards to the disarmament of Iraq to gather intelligence about the security of Saddam Hussein, something that the inspectors had no right to go after. And in 1998, I resigned from my position as a chief inspector of the United Nations in Iraq because I felt I could no longer do my job because the United States was interfering with my work and the work of the inspectors.
Scott, you just said that Iraq was in fact lying and hiding information regarding their weapons systems. What did you actually experience directly as a weapons inspector in Iraq in terms of finding or not finding chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons?
Well, I think there's a couple things that people have to consider when talking about the inspection program that I was involved in. One is that every inspection was different. It's not as though, these were cookie-cutter operations where if you did one inspection, you've done them all. Every inspection was different. Every inspection was created to accomplish a specific purpose, whether it was interviewing Iraqi scientists. You might only need a few inspectors for that. If it's doing a technical analysis of a factory to see what it can or can't produce in the way of material which is prescribed by Security Council resolution, that's a different issue. If it's doing a no-notice inspection of a facility to determine whether documents exist that might pertain to Iraqi weapons programs or there might be any residue of past prohibited activity, that's a different inspection. Every inspection was different. And the inspection process went on for 7 years. So inspections that took place in 1991 were of a totally different character than inspections that took place in 1992 or 1993 or 1994. The sequencing of inspections over the course of time, you had to incorporate that which you learned, that which you experienced the year before. So, for somebody to say, well, I was a weapons inspector in 1991, I can tell you what weapons inspections are like, they're wrong, because inspections in 1996 were totally different. And if you experienced inspections in 1996, you can't tell me you know what an inspection was in 1998. It's a totally different inspection, a totally different set of circumstances. For instance, from 1991 to 1993, we know the Iraqis had a concerted program to lie and deceive and conceal information from the weapons inspectors, primarily in the area of material, the hardware of chemical, biological, nuclear, or long-range ballistic missiles. We inspectors broke through this wall of concealment, this deception, and compelled the Iraqis to either turn over this material to the inspectors or to destroy it unilaterally in a panic in the way that a drug dealer would flush drugs down a toilet when cops come into their house. That's what the Iraqis did. And then we would have to go out to the sites of destruction and reconstruct the scene like a forensic investigator. There's a popular TV show, Crime Scene Investigator. Well, that's what inspectors were many times, crime scene investigators, going to the scene of an event and having to reconstruct it forensically to determine what occurred. But by 1993, we were pretty much able to determine that there was no significant quantities of material left in Iraq. We could ascertain that we could account for 90 to 95% of that which Iraq produced from their factories. We were also involved in destroying material, that which the Iraqis turned over. From 1993 to 1995, we were primarily looking for documents, you know, doing document search, doing technical analysis of facilities that we were subjecting to monitoring, ongoing monitoring and verification. Another important part of the inspection process. You know, we monitored the totality of Iraq's industrial infrastructure. For those who say, well, Iraq's a big country, they could produce a lot of stuff. Wrong answer. Iraq may be a big country, but in terms of their industrial facilities, you don't produce biological weapons in a cave or in a basement. You produce it at a industrial facility, the same with chemical weapons, nuclear weapons, etc. And there's a finite number of industrial facilities in Iraq. We were aware of them all, and we inspected them all, and we subjected them to ongoing monitoring and verification, where we would have 24-hour surveillance cameras, no-notice inspections by personnel, special sensors to detect whether or not there was the presence of any chemical agent in the air, aerial surveillance. And, you know, we did this from 1993 to 1995. Around 1995, again, thanks to the inspection process, the Iraqis had not only turned over their hardware or their factories, but they also coughed up their documents, the databases of knowledge that one would need to reconstitute these programs. And I would say that by 1996, Iraq was fundamentally disarmed. There was nothing left in Iraq. We still had a certain quantity of material that we could not confirm the final disposition of, and we spent from 1996 to 1998 searching Iraq in vain, as it turned out, for this material. But, I've just defined, three or four separate epochs in terms of the inspection process. So one could understand that, an inspection in one epoch would be different from an inspection in the other. It's a very complicated story, but it's a successful story. It's one that shows that, the United Nations can put together a multilateral-based disarmament program that can succeed in eliminating entire categories of weapons. We were very successful in Iraq. The shame is that the international community was unable or unwilling to recognize our success.
And in fact, you have written that it was the United States government that actively ended the weapons inspection. And as you describe in your book, Frontier Justice, that Sheriff Bush, as you describe him, was presenting and is presenting a big lie. Tell me about the lie that has been presented by the U.S. government, and also maybe describe a little about what I think people might not know too much about. You go into detail into the PNAC and even describe President Bush as being somewhat of a puppet or front man for others with clear imperialist intentions.
Well, let's understand one thing from the get-go. The United States has never had as its preeminent policy objective regarding Iraq disarmament being the number one priority. Disarmament isn't a priority for the United States. Regime removal is, getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Since 1991, regime removal has been the policy of the United States. Three successive presidencies, George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, and today George W. Bush, have embarked on policies to remove Saddam Hussein from power. Disarmament was merely a facade, a sham, and an excuse to put in place policies or procedures backed by the United Nations that would contain and destabilize Saddam Hussein. Economic sanctions. If you take a look at every resolution passed by the United Nations pertaining to economic sanctions against Iraq, or any resolution for that matter, you won't find a single word that speaks of regime removal, eliminating Saddam Hussein. Economic sanctions were linked to Iraq's disarmament obligation. But the United States had committed publicly since 1991 to a policy that said economic sanctions would never be lifted even if Iraq cooperated and complied with its disarmament obligation, until which time Saddam Hussein was removed from power. So there's the big lie right there. Right from the get-go, the American people need to understand that weapons of mass destruction have always been this artificial issue from the standpoint of the United States. We've never been focused on it. We've only used it as a vehicle, as an excuse to pursue this overall policy objective of regime removal. George Bush took it to another extreme. You see, the first two presidencies, George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton, used the weapons of mass destruction issue as the conduit for containing Saddam Hussein, for keeping economic sanctions in place, which economically hogtied the Iraqi economy, which destabilized the central authority of Baghdad by preventing Saddam Hussein from having total control of the economy, of total control of his territory, and then using the inspection process itself to spy on Saddam Hussein, to gather intelligence so that specific CIA-backed attempts to remove him could be mounted. They all failed. George W. Bush took it the next step. He realized that this containment policy was a failure. I say he realized. There's a larger group of neoconservative ideologues who have used the Iraq issue as a vehicle to do two things. One, bash Democrats, i.e. Bill Clinton, for being weak on American security, saying that Bill Clinton was unable or unwilling to confront the greatest threat to America, to the people of the United States. By allowing Saddam Hussein to stay in power, Bill Clinton, was allowing a government that supported international terror, that was creating weapons of mass destruction, that was defying the international community, and Saddam Hussein's defiance was in itself a destabilizing factor, and Saddam needed to be removed. That was this group known as the Project for a New American Century. They had, since the mid-1990s, promulgated ideological thought which said that the United States must impose its will on the international community, on the world, to establish American hegemony, American imperial power. And the first case study for implementation of this new American imperialism was Iraq, a ready target, Saddam Hussein, already known to the American people, an easy sell. These guys trace their roots back to, the Ronald Reagan years and the concept of, America being the bastion of good versus, the forces of evil. Ronald Reagan's evil empire was readily translated into George W. Bush's axis of evil. It's the same thought process, the same mindset, except Ronald Reagan never took it to the extremes that these neoconservative fundamentalists have. They have hijacked the national security agenda of the United States, and indeed the domestic security agenda, in the name of their own ideology. And they are running this country using that ideology as the basis for everything we do. Americans like to think that the Constitution is the defining document of our country. But when you look at the Bush administration and the neoconservatives who have surrounded the president, there's two documents Americans need to be familiar with. These are the documents that define how we operate as a nation today. One is the National Security Strategy of the United States, published by the Bush administration in September of 2002, which speaks of imposing American imperial hegemony on the entire globe. They don't use those exact words, but that's the net effect of this policy. It says we will not pay attention to multilateralism. We are speaking about unilateralism, only the American way. We will reject the United Nations, reject other nations' point of view when it clashes with the America First philosophy. And the other one is the Patriot Act, which was imposed on the United States, the people of America, in the aftermath of September 11th. It's a frontal assault on the Constitution of the United States of America. It's a direct attack on individual civil liberties. And now we are, we hear talk of Patriot Act 2. Which is a follow-on, an expansion of these powers that the government now has over the American people. Both these documents were drafted well before the events of September 11, 2001, the attack on the World Trade Center, and yet both have been sold to the American people as being a necessary result of September 11th, part of the big lie, you see. We're told that because we were attacked on September 11th, the Bush administration had to undertake these radical policy transformations. But these radical policy transformations were conceived and drafted and prepared before the events of September 11th. The Bush administration was waiting for a trigger event to come along, and that trigger event tragically took place on September 11th. The Bush administration has capitalized on the fear generated by that horrible day to prey on the ignorance of the American people. The American people are universally ignorant about what goes on outside of their borders. Look at today. Polls say 70% of Americans believe that there is a link between September 11th and Saddam Hussein. Well, where do they get their data? Because even Donald Rumsfeld and Vice President Cheney and Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, have come out and said there is no link between those. Now, they sold that link before we invaded Iraq, but now, confronted with the harsh reality of truth and fact, they have to acknowledge there is no link. And yet, Americans continue to believe it. Why? Because the Bush administration, President Bush himself, has sold this lie to the American people. Every time the man speaks about Iraq, speaks about international affairs, he invokes the image of September 11th, and he capitalizes on the fear generated by that event and the ignorance of the American people to sell them a lie. He sold them not only a lie between the link between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda and those who actually perpetrated the events of September 11th, he also sold the lie of weapons of mass destruction and the threat posed by Saddam Hussein in the form of weapons of mass destruction. President Bush knew what the truth was. The neoconservatives that surround him know what the truth was. There was no evidence that linked, that sustained the allegation that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction today. But President Bush told the lie. He told it often, and he told it with passion. And many people were fearful of confronting him on the facts, so they bought into the lie. Not just the people of the United States, but the Congress of the United States, the American media, everybody is culpable in buying into this big lie. And the end result is we have been betrayed. We are now in a war that we cannot win, a war that will cost us not only a tremendous amount of lives, but a tremendous amount of capital, a war that has damaged the credibility of the United States internationally. And it's all based on the lie told by President Bush, a lie that was shaped by these neoconservative ideologues who, you know, came together in the form of the Project for New American Century sometime in the mid-1990s. And these are people that, you know, the American people hadn't even heard of in the 2000 election. You know, we didn't know. You know, ask an American what the Project for New American Century was in 2000, they wouldn't know. They thought they were voting for George W. Bush or for Al Gore. Immediately after Bush got elected, the Project for New American Century seized control of the American government. These people were appointed to the senior-most positions in the decision-making hierarchy of the national security establishment of the United States, and now they control how decisions are made, what decisions are made. And there's not informed consent on the part of the American public. We didn't vote for that. We didn't know that we're bringing in this group of neoconservative, neo-fascists who have, who are now running the show, who have gotten us in trouble in Afghanistan, gotten us in trouble in Iraq, and who knows where you're going to get us in trouble next.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. My name is John Malkin, and I'm speaking this evening with Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector and author of the newly released Frontier Justice, Weapons of Mass Destruction and the Bushwhacking of America. Scott, you have been a very outspoken critic opposing the oligarchy and fascism, as you put it, of the American empire. And I'm wondering to what extent you have felt attacked because of that. In your book, Frontier Justice, there's a section where you're describing being contacted by the FBI to meet with them, and you felt that this had been possibly a result of the amount of phone calls. It says, the amount of phone calls I had been making on my cell phone about the Iraq initiative, together with the related email traffic, I wasn't surprised to find the FBI newly energized about my case. To what extent do you feel that you were being harassed because you were raising your voice about these lies?
Well, I won't say I was harassed by the FBI. Actually, the FBI was pretty upfront about their concerns. I wasn't just vocal, I was active. I went to Iraq. I made a documentary movie. I went and spoke with the Iraqi National Assembly, imploring the Iraqi government to allow inspectors back in as a way of avoiding war. So I think the FBI's major concern was that you have this former intelligence officer who knows a great deal about the national security of the United States having what is, in their opinion, uncontrolled contact with a state that's openly hostile to the United States. And because, I was a former national security official with the U.S. government, I respect that. I understand where they're coming from, and I've always cooperated with the FBI openly. I've been very upfront with them about what I'm doing, who I'm doing it with, why I'm doing it, how I'm doing it. And I just would hope that they would return that respect, recognize that I am an American citizen. I have a right to speak out and do what I need to do within the law. And as long as I'm obeying the law, they shouldn't obstruct it. So it's not that I blame the FBI for harassment. I have a problem, though, with the what I would call the untidy relationship between the government, and the FBI is a part of the federal government, and these neoconservative ideologues. There are those out there there are people outside of government who have taken it upon themselves to view anyone who dares speak out against President Bush or the policy of the Bush administration as being unpatriotic, as being treasonous. Just listen to Ann Coulter, speak. This is a woman who's gone totally, off her rocker in condemning anybody who dares speak out against the president as somehow, a criminal in intent, treasonous, anti-American. And, God forbid you have somebody who actually knows what they're talking about speak out against the president. And I think when it comes to Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, I knew what I was talking about. I'm proud of the fact that people cannot contradict me on a single point of fact that I've ever uttered about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. I stand today vindicated totally by the course of events in Iraq. David Kaye, the CIA official who's overseeing the Iraq Survey Group, cannot issue a report right now because he has no data to sustain the allegations that Iraq had a weapons of mass destruction program. They simply didn't. And I was very clear in that in the years leading up to this war that there was no threat in Iraq stemming from weapons of mass destruction worthy of war, worthy of the expenditure of one American life. How do you deal with a voice that has this kind of credibility, this kind of authority? You can't debate it, because I'll win every debate hands down, not from my debating skills, but from the fact that I have a solid foundation of fact upon which to draw. You do it by misdirecting the attention of the American public. You don't want to talk to Scott Ritter about weapons of mass destruction. Well, let's talk about Scott Ritter being a tool of Saddam Hussein. Let's talk about Scott Ritter as being somebody who might have character flaw issues. We'll talk about anything but weapons of mass destruction. And unfortunately, the media was all too compliant in meeting the goals and objectives of these neoconservative character assassins. The TV went crazy on a number of issues. The newspapers went crazy, and then having thrown something out there that theoretically sullies the character of an individual, the media shuns the individual, removing that voice from the debate or a debate that could have existed. It's just the tactic that's used. It's as old as politics, muckraking, mudslinging, whatever. I just happen to be the target of it. I don't blame the government. I blame the neoconservatives who are basically an extra-governmental organization in this case, closely linked to the governing authorities, and basically doing things that the government could never get away of. You won't find the FBI smearing my name. That's not their job. But you will find, the Weekly Standard, Billy Crystal's group, the Project for New American Century, the Wall Street Journal's op-ed pages. These are non-governmental institutions that have basically been taken over by these neoconservative ideologues who are, you know, blindly loyal to President Bush.
Scott, in your recent book, Frontier Justice, you mentioned many times your view that democracy in the United States is in a dire state and that people here need to increase their participation and also stop handing power and influence over to a small elite. I wonder what suggestions you have in restoring democracy in America and also your view of the anti-globalization movement in the United States and internationally and the peace movement.
Well, I'm, you know, if you're going to, you know, quote unquote restore democracy, I think you have to identify what the ideal is. You know, we hear a lot of talk right now about the informed consent of the American public. You know, how can you have informed consent if you don't have an open debate, dialogue, and discussion of events? We didn't have that on Iraq. So I can never think that we had the informed consent of the American public. I don't think the American public today understands what was going on in Iraq, what is going on in Iraq. So the first element of getting this thing called American democracy back up to being, you know, a healthy, functioning reality is the education of the American public. We have to become smarter about, you know, that which defines us as a people, that which we are involved with as a people. How do you do this? You know, what guidelines do you use? Well, I would say let's start small. How do we act as a community? I mean, a local community. You know, I live in a small town here in New York. You know, when the school board needs more money, they hold a forum. People discuss it. Then it comes up to vote, and people participate. A higher percentage of people participate in local politics than you see in the national political arena. People care about their local community. Why don't we care about our nation as much as we do about the local community? You know, we wouldn't let a mayor run roughshod over us the way the president is. So the first thing is get educated, find out what it is you need to know about in regards to this country, and the second is to participate, to become involved, to invest yourself as a citizen. This is going to require many Americans rethinking their role as citizens. Tragically, I think most Americans have become consumers, not citizens. That we have wrapped ourselves in a cocoon of comfort, and as long as the government, whether it's Republican or Democrat, keeps us waddling down the relative path of prosperity, we're not going to do anything that rocks the boat. And we call that citizenship, but it's not. That's consumerism. A citizen is somebody who takes a look around, who invests themselves, who gets involved in issues. And you know, it's up to Americans to decide at what level you want to get involved in. I happen to be somebody who knows something about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, so that's my involvement. You might be somebody who knows about the ecology and local environmental issues, and so maybe you limit your involvement to, you know, your town, to your county, to your state. That's still active citizenship. We need citizens to be involved across the spectrum, because if we don't get involved, you know, there's still a job that needs to be done. Who's going to do it? And what happens is, as consumers, we tend to cede that responsibility to others, a power elite who steps in and fills the void, the leadership void that we, the people, have created by our lack of involvement, and this power elite starts calling the shots. And the power elite sustains their hold on power by keeping us disengaged from what's going on. And, you know, they do that by throwing us some bones, keeping that consumerism going, keeping us happy, prosperous, or relatively prosperous, but also keeping us totally disengaged from what's really going on in our name. Remember, in our name, it's a critical concept, because the Constitution speaks of we, the people of the United States of America, in order to form a more perfect union. We are the government. We are responsible. It doesn't say, you know, we the few who have total control over the majority of Americans who do nothing. It says we the people. So we the people need to become more involved in what we do as a collective. And again, it's not just, you know, what's done within our borders. We need to recognize that today we live in a global community and that the United States is a major player in this global community. And I think we have a responsibility, again, to divorce ourselves from this concept of consumerism that drives us. You know, Americans consume more than any other group of people in the world. And where do we get these resources? We don't get them from here domestically. It's not as though we, you know, are a nation that produces all that which sustains us. We have to get it from abroad. And we have to do so in a way which makes it affordable for us here at home. So we end up having a foreign policy as a end result that allows us to go to an Angola and make deals with warlords and cruel dictators so that we can pump oil out at favorable rates, or go into a Congo and pull out materials out of the ground, special minerals that enable us to make cell phones affordably, even though it means subjecting a million people to slave labor. We need to understand that the same benefits that we espouse to the term American, I'm an American, I have a right to do this because I'm an American, I have a right to do this. What we need to do is stop saying American and start saying I have a right to do this because I'm a human, because I'm a person. We need to remember that a Pakistani is a human being too. And that if it's good for Americans, then it better be good for Pakistanis. We can't have a double standard that says that a black Sudanese, doesn't deserve the same quality of life that a white American does. We have to break free of this concept of, America being unique. Oh, we are unique. We are special. We are empowered. We are different. But we have to take advantage of this unique status that we enjoy, not to continue to isolate ourselves, in this triangle, this pyramid where we occupy the top, everybody else is below us. We have to find a way to coexist with the rest of the world in a manner which, is beneficial to all. We can't keep sucking, the lifeblood out of impoverished people around the world. And again, I think if Americans invested themselves in their communities and understood what it meant to be a citizen, understood what it meant to be a human being, we might start viewing how we interact with the world a little bit different. As long as we continue just to wrap ourselves in this cocoon of comfort, we're nothing more than consumers. Consumers who are being played by a power elite who are looking out for things other than the benefit of, all the people. We the people who govern the United States.
Scott, I'd like to ask you one more question if you're up for that.
Sure.
Thank you. Your writing and testimonies, reports, and statements regarding weapons inspections and weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and especially statements about Iraq having definitely hidden information about their weapon systems, these statements that you have made have ironically been used by others both to support a pro-war stance and by others to support an anti-war stance. I wonder what your personal view is, what your feeling is about the United States wars on Iraq in 1991 and the more recent war and all the warring in between. I wonder what your view is on these wars, if you supported them at all. And I wonder your view on the usefulness of nonviolence as a method of social change.
Well, let's just start right off the bat. I'm not a pacifist. I spent 12 years in the Marine Corps, and I've gone to war for my country, and I'm trained as a warrior. So we need to recognize from the start, from the outset, what kind of person you're talking to here. I would say this, though. When I put on the uniform of the United States Marine, I did so not to go out and wage war. I did so to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I did so to defend the American people, to defend you, to defend everybody in my country from threats. Not to go out and be a legionnaire in some imperial army to impose the will of a president and those who surround him, or her, if a woman's ever elected, but to defend. And I recognize that war is a horrible, horrible thing. something you don't want to be engaged in frivolously. You only go to war as a last resort. You only ask Americans to give their lives for their fellow Americans when all other options have been exhausted. We joined the United Nations and we signed the United Nations Charter in the aftermath of the Second World War because, according to the Charter, we recognized that war was no longer acceptable as a means of resolving disputes between nations, that nations need to figure out another way of dealing with their differences other than military conflict, or else we will cease to exist as the human race. We'll just end up killing ourselves. But even the Charter, in embracing this noble concept of avoiding war, recognize that the world's not a perfect place, and there comes a time and a place in which one must act to defend themselves. And in the Charter, there's at least two instances in which military action, war, is legitimate. One is legitimate self-defense. If you attack me, I can defend myself. So I'm allowed to prepare military forces in my defense. And if you come after me, you violate my sovereignty, you attack me, I will defend myself. I happen to be someone who takes this concept of self-defense to an extreme. I believe in preemptive defense. If I see you picking up a baseball bat and taking watermelons and painting them to look like my head, and you spend all day bashing these watermelons saying you're going to kill me, and I find out that you have a plan to break into my house and wait till I'm asleep and hit me over the head with a baseball bat, I'd sort of be a darn fool to let you get away with that. I would do what I could to preempt that. I'd have to have good intelligence to know that that's what you wanted to do, but if I did have that good intelligence, then I should be able to preempt, your act of aggression. I still view that as self-defense. Another one is if a threat exists to the collective security. Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter speaks of collective security. It says if the Security Council finds that a threat exists to the international peace and security, the Security Council can pass a resolution authorizing military force to be undertaken to resolve that. When Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990, Iraq violated the sovereignty of an independent state. Under Article 51, self-defense, Kuwait is allowed to defend itself. Kuwait could no longer defend itself, so it appeals to the Security Council for assistance. The Security Council recognizes the illegitimacy of the Iraqi action and passes a resolution under Chapter 7, which authorizes military force to be used to liberate Kuwait. It's a war, and it's horrible, but, it's a just war. And I fought in that war. I fought in the war to liberate Kuwait. You can sit there and pick apart different things that were done during that war and say how horrible they were, and I'll say, you're darn right they were horrible. We bombed sites that killed civilians. Yes, it's tragic. Do I want to do that? Absolutely not. Did it happen? Yes. Why? Because it's war. I think the first thing people have to understand is that war isn't a game. War is about killing. All right, when we're going to talk about war, let's remember that people get blown to bits, and a lot of the people that get blown to bits are women and children, and they don't just die instantly. They lay in the ground screaming, writhing in pain as their blood oozes out. War is horrible. It's more horrible than anybody can possibly imagine, which is why we should never go to war unless it's the absolute last, choice, the last option out there. And I think in the case of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, in order to right that wrong, war was required. There's a huge difference between the war we fought against Iraq in 1991 and the war that was raged in 2003 of this year. First of all, there was a legitimacy to the military action in 1991. The international community spoke. The Security Council passed a resolution. It was a war designed to liberate Kuwait, not occupy Iraq. It was designed to right a wrong. It was based on a fundamental truth that Iraq invaded Kuwait illegally and violated Kuwait's sovereignty, and the international community was obligated by the Charter to reverse course, to evict Iraq. That's a truth. Not what happened in 2003, where President Bush lied to the American people, lied to the American Congress, lied to the international community about a non-existent threat. The Security Council refused to endorse the American military action. The Congress of the United States didn't declare war, but instead abrogated their constitutional responsibilities by giving the president war powers authority in October 2002, months before he made his, or at least he openly made his final choice about going to war with Iraq. In 2003, this was not about righting a wrong. This was always about implementing a wrong. It was about American imposition of its, you know, vision of global hegemony, using Iraq as the case study for this implementation. So there's two totally different things here. You know, when we talk about war, I supported the war in 1991. I did not support the war in 2003. I think this war that we currently have waged against Iraq and are waging today is an illegal war. It's a war that has shamed America, has put a huge stain on the moral character of our country and of the people who live in our country. Remember, we the people, we are America. We're to blame for what's happened here. We are all culpable. The other thing, too, I would say, is when you look at this war, this was an avoidable war. And I also think that if you take a look back at 1991, that's an avoidable war. There's almost no war out there today that isn't avoidable. The way communications work with the technology that we have in terms of gathering information, in terms of getting people together, there's simply no excuse for war today. I don't view what Osama bin Laden did to the United States on September 11, 2001 as an act of war. I view it as a giant crime. I view him as a criminal. I view his organization as a criminal organization. They committed murder that day. I don't view the American response being characterized as a war as being appropriate. If it was a giant police action, I would agree with that. I don't think that there's an excuse for nations going to war today. There's simply no reason why things can't be worked out diplomatically. And you know, when you look at things, we have to get over this, Neanderthal caveman-like tendency to thump our chest and say we need to prove how bad we are by beating somebody up. No, America doesn't need to prove anything to anybody on the military field of battle. That's garbage, because when you talk about America's going to prove itself, what you're saying is Americans are going to die. There's a family or families, hundreds of families, are going to lose loved ones. You're saying Americans are going to kill. We're going to slaughter people. Think about how the Iraqis feel every night when we go in there and murder their men, maim their men, murder their women. Because it is murder. We're not there legitimately. Everything we do in Iraq is illegal, illegitimate. Every time we take a life, it's an illegal act right there. We're committing murder. And think how the Iraqis feel about that. Think of the cost. The president just spoke of $87 billion going on top of his originally $60 billion, and that's just the beginning of the cost of this. And imagine if you'd just given a tenth of that to diplomacy and given it a chance. You know, how many people would be alive today, how much would not be destroyed by military action, and how much money we'd have left over to do really worthwhile things such as fund education, fund health care, fund social reforms, to take care of the people of the United States, to take care of the people of the world. War is a waste, a pure waste. Again, I'm not a pacifist. You attack me, I'll take you down. I'll take you down harder than you could imagine. But war is a horrible thing, and it must be viewed, and every American needs to start viewing it as the absolute last resort. And in the case of Iraq 2003, we didn't even begin to exhaust the alternative, avenues of resolving the dispute with Iraq. Because how can you resolve something if you're not honest about it? The Bush administration never had any intention of allowing weapons inspections to work. They worked. They worked. We disarmed Iraq. Iraq has been disarmed for over 10 years now. There have been no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq for over 10 years now. And everybody knew it. And yet we went to war. Went to war on a lie. We have got to find a way to educate the people of the United States of America to recognize that war is not a good thing. War is a horrible thing. We should not seek to go to war. We don't prove anything by going to war other than we're capable of killing people. And what's to be proud in that? What's to be proud in that? So, I'm not a pacifist, but I tell you what, I certainly endorse a nonviolent approach to problem solving.
Scott Ritter, I want to thank you so very much for speaking with me this evening on Free Radio Santa Cruz. And I have enjoyed reading your book, Frontier Justice. It has been very illuminating with detailed accounts of your time as a UN weapons inspector, and then a lot of information about you speaking out all over the world to government organizations as well as in public forums, and your relationship with media. And I appreciate all the work that you've done. I wonder, aside from your new book from Context Books, Frontier Justice, what's another good source for information and education for people that you might recommend?
You know, it's tough because I don't trust too many conventional media outlets. I think that they're still, you know, when you're culpable in a great wrong, you don't like to admit that you're culpable. So I think a lot of the media is carrying out revisionist history right now, and you're not getting, you know, the full story at this point in time. It's a tough thing. There's no single source out there that I can say go there and be 100% certain that you're going to get the right thing. I think there's a lot of good progressive groups out there. Trap Rock Peace Center out of Massachusetts is one, and there's others. I think William Rivers Pitts runs a nice, information source, Truth Out. But basically, the consumer of news and information is going to have to become a citizen and invest themselves into, you know, this problem of wading through the data that's out there to determine that which is relevant, that which is worthy of their attention. I wish I could give you an easier answer than that, but there isn't one.
Scott, thank you so very much for being with me on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I appreciate it very much, and I wish you well in your work.
Well, thank you very much.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM.
Colors that you fly, love just one nation, and the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry, there is no other choice. God bless the people, men cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find the solution and disease. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Violence brings one thing, more and more of the same. Military madness, smell of flesh and burning pain. So I sing out to the masses, stand up if you're still sane. For all of us gone crazy, I sing this one refrain. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find a solution
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. The name of this program is The Great Leap Forward. It airs every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. here on 96.3 in Santa Cruz and on the internet at www.freakradio.org. The studio phone number here is 831-427-FRSC. Our voicemail number is 831-427-4523. We are community-based and appreciate donations of any amount. You can make checks payable to Free Radio Santa Cruz and send them to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061.